But unless we see it, and we concede you have to see it to make a difference, right, it doesn't land. And that's always going to be the greatest, that's always going to be one of the significant challenges.
Yeah, it is a challenge, but I think, Greg, in particular, you mentioned the Gaza crisis. People do see it. We've had thousands on the streets every single week marching to tell our government to take strong action in relation to Gaza and the decades-long oppression of the people of Palestine. So people do see it. It's then about getting our elected leaders to take action on it. And
yeah,
I think you know, TROCRA has a lot of, actions towards we're trying to advocate towards the government to implement the Occupied Territories Bill, for example. People can put pressure on their TDs to do that, to push for that.
Well, that's how people make a change, and they can be change makers, I suppose,
absolutely.
Which ties into the name of this.
And that's where change comes from. It comes from the bottom up, you know, comes from the grassroots.
Roisin, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. Roisin O'Hara is Outreach Manager for TROCRA Northern Ireland, and also Hugh Bergen, Development Education Facilitator with Self-Help Africa. I mean, you could really dig deep into these issues, couldn't you? But listen, for now, both of you, thank you very much for your time. I do appreciate it. Okay, you're very welcome. Welcome back to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. A little bit of a format change today. We're broadcasting live from Ongrianon Hotel in Burt. It's part of the Changemakers Donegal Seminar. And we're joined in our studio here by Bernadette McCallisky, who is an Irish activist. Bernadette, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much for covering the conference.
No, it's our pleasure. Now, you'll be speaking at this conference a little later on. Tell us the thrust of what you'll be talking about.
Well, I think I'm being interrogated by interrogated by Roisin from TROCRA. And I suppose, as with the rest of today's conference and activities, the main topic of conversation will be about interconnectedness, about change, the need to change, why change matters, and I suppose not just about change makers, but how do we make change? How do we get people on board with changing the things we are, the way they are, to something better, and that at a community level, that's not just about, it's not just about what our politicians are doing or what our big organisations are doing, but as we say in Tyrone, if it's not working in Coal Island, it's not working.
Yeah. And, obviously...
It's difficult, that noise.
I beg your pardon, Bernadette. Mm-hmm. I'll speak as loud as I can. Obviously, you know, you get this and you hope to spread the word so others do. Where did that come from for you?
Well, like many people, you don't realise where it's coming from until you've started to do it in the short term. I suppose the first influence is fairly local, immediate, and my own was from, as a young student, engagement in the civil rights movement and trying to change the things that impacted on me, and then very much learning that it wasn't just about me, you know. There are much of the things that were happening here were happening in different ways to other people. And I suppose a realization that if you want something for yourself, if you want a better experience for yourself, if you want rights for yourself, if you want inclusion and equality for yourself, then you're going to have to buy in to sharing that with everybody else, and give as well as take. So I suppose that's where I came from.
And what would you say your earliest influence in that regard was? Because, I mean, you can go back to your student days, you know, where you were very active. But where were the seeds, do you feel the seeds were planted for you?
Well, I think for me personally, I'm very clear about where they were. They were in my own childhood, in my own family. And, my particular family history, we were poor, but we weren't we weren't impoverished until my father died when we were very young. I was 9 years of age when my father died. And my mother was a very young woman, 36, with six children. So first of all, there was the impact of my father's way of thinking and my father and mother's view, which, you know, when I was young, and I was born in 47, so in that period between, say, 47, 56, when my dad died, and later on, I grew up in a family where children were not expected to be seen and not heard, where we, you know, where we were actively encouraged to read, to think. My father was a trade unionist. My mother was, we used to say my mother was a charismatic Catholic before they were invented.
I love it.
And was a fair bit of the Presbyterian Catholic in her as well. You know, I remember at Vatican II, which we didn't know a lot about as children, but one of the offshoots was that a number of saints were demoted. And my mother's a devout Catholic, had an affinity with these saints. And so she had a little May altar and some statues on it. But when the Pope demoted the saints, we kind of as teenagers teased her to say, you know, what's going to happen now, Mum? And she said, well, I'll just move them to the back until the Pope sees the error of his ways.
I love it. You talked a little bit earlier on about how we have to make change. And, you know, I wouldn't say criticism of elected politics or democracy as we have it. But you did serve yourself, right? Was that because that's... Well, why did you go for it? If you have a sort of a hesitancy about it, I don't know how... I don't want to frame your view, right? Mm-hmm. I want you to do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could argue that you don't think it works, but you became part of it for
that's
a time.
Right. That's right.
Why?
First of all, I do think, you know, the delegation of authority and representative politics as a concept works. As the way we organise it, it doesn't. I suppose if I say in my own defence, when I was young, I didn't know that at the time, and I didn't. I became an elected representative by accident and default. I had stood for election as part of the People's Democracy Student Movement. With no intention of being elected. It was a student, I suppose, agitation, education and disruption of the election to stand candidates, which the People's Democracy did, against, in the North, both unionist and nationalist candidates, in order to have that platform to say our own piece. And to our consternation, one of the people nearly got elected, and was the only person who on the count appeared to have been elected by something like 10 votes, and demanded a recount. The successful candidate demanded a recount, and to his relief, lost by a handful of votes. So I kind of became then a Westminster MP by the same, if you like, mistaken tactic that I ended up being chosen, and once chosen, stood for the election and got elected. But I'm not saying it doesn't have its place. It's a very seductive process whereby people of good intent go into elected positions on the basis of getting the outcomes on which they stood for election. And then you get very slowly, like slowly boiling a frog, you come to the mistaken belief that getting these outcomes is totally dependent on you always being elected. So you start then to prioritise not offending people.
You become part of the system, really, yeah. Effectively,
so you
don't
stop
you?
Offending people, and you don't notice that in order not to offend them, yeah. You're moving further and further back to accommodate what people are afraid of instead of standing up for what you believe.
And I've witnessed exactly what you're talking about.
And then you're bought in, you're co-opted.
Now, Bernadette, if you were speaking to a group of young people or people of any age, okay, and they say, I want to be a change maker. We're at the moment heading into local elections here, European elections. What would your advice be if they wanted to be a change maker and they thought the best way maybe was elected politics? I'm not saying you would discourage them.
No, I wouldn't.
But what would you say? Would you say, well, would you be of the view that that is the best way to make a change?
What I'd say, it's not the only way. I would say in terms of keeping, I'd say to any young person, there are a number of ways you can do that. If you want to do it this way, I'm going to give you some solid advice. Every morning when you're cleaning your teeth, check you still have your integrity, your vision, your hope. Because it is the most seductive way of ensuring that you don't become a change maker unless you criticize yourself every day. And if somebody, young person, says to me, I want to make a career in politics, I would say to everybody else, don't select that young person.
It's funny, I've seen a trend now of people seeking election and they get what you're saying and their promises that I'll send out an email every week to show the change that I'm making. Mm-hmm. And I've got a note in the back of my head to see how long these emails
That's
last.
Right. And to see how...
Go ahead.
You see it all the time. This is what I've done. And people in the community, you know, who are funded, understand the same process. If you want to make change, we need outcome, not output. So I don't want to know how many emails you sent. I want to know very carefully what you said in them.
Yeah.
And I want to know how brave you have been in running against the tide when the tide is wrong. And you don't get that then, you know, when people...
Well, you see, the problem with that criteria, Bernadette, is they might have very little information to return to the electorate.
That's right. And that is a problem, yeah. Because people would say, that's the easy bit. I sent out emails, I shook hands, I kissed babies, I spoke. I got up and I spoke, but I would need to know, and how much change do you think that's going to make?
You're talking about pushing back, really, about words or policies or the system.
Yeah.
But you, during your time, and your life is such that I feel bad sort of skipping through it, but... in speaking out and becoming a leading figure in the people's democracy, you know what I mean? You've seen some tough stuff. You and your husband also were shot and badly wounded in the early 80s, but yet you still kept going. You stuck to your laurels, you stuck to your morals. Through all that adversary that I've brushed over, and my apologies for that, but Bernadette, people who know you will know what I'm talking about. What keeps you, what kept you, maybe it's easier now, right? But it seems to me that the Westminster experiences maybe put you off track more than the other stuff I've referenced, right? That's the impression I'm getting. Yeah. But how did you keep going?
Well, I think when I left, you know, and people think of me as a member of Parliament, although I left in 1974, and I came out of the community. I grew up, you know, I grew up in amongst, as we would say, amongst the plain people. That wasn't by choice. I was born into a working class rural community. But there was a point at which I made an emotional, intellectual, political and ethical choice that's the best place to be, to live and to work. And so from the mid-80s, after my husband and I were shot, we had to relocate the family, and the only place we could find in a hurry was in the poorest housing estate in Coal Island.
Yes.
And we lived there for 15 years. And then as soon as the peace came, we went back to the rural community that we wanted to live in. But for me, what keeps me going all the time is that I believe in people. I believe in humanity. I believe that human beings are good creatures. We like to think we're rational, but we're also instinctive, and we're good. I think that the basic instinct.
I think we forget that actually. That yes, basically we're good.
Basically, the instinct of human beings is social, collective, caring, and good. And so I've spent the rest of my life organizing in communities and doing this kind of work. And I think it's the most creative, the most rewarding, and the most hopeful place to be. And all change starts at this level.
Well, I shan't hold you back from making change any longer. Bernadette, it's been lovely speaking to you. Thank you so very much indeed. That's Bernadette McCallisky, an Irish activist. If you're not familiar with Bernadette and her work and her life story, I'd strongly recommend that you... do a little bit of research on it. It really is quite fascinating. All right, you're tuned to the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio this Friday. Thank you so much for your company. Keep the texts and calls coming into us. You text us by WhatsApp 086 60 25000. That is also, of course, that is also our text and WhatsApp number. Give us a call on 07491 25000, 07491 25000, and emails comments at highlandradio.com. People shouldn't forget, says the listener, that they are the ones that have the power. We just hand over to the government, hoping they'll do the best for us. But sadly, they don't. We have our chance to get them to listen to us now when they're asking for their jobs. Okay, I think that's one I actually read already, but no harm reading it again. Okay, we'll be back with more on the programme after we take this short commercial break. Stay right where you are. Okay, you're welcome back to the programme. 35 minutes of the show left here live from On Green on Hotel in Burt. We're here as part of Change Makers Donegal seminar, and there's a huge crowd here, and there's talks and speeches ongoing at the moment. You'll hear the occasional round of applause if that's what you're picking up in the background. Okay, our next two guests with me here are Myra McHugh of Rathmullen Tidy Towns. Hiya, Myra.
Hi, Greg.
Good to have you with us.
Thank
Hazel
you.
Russell is part of Rathmullen Coast Care and Tidy Towns Committee as well. Good morning, Hazel. Great to have you with us. Oshin, I might just ask you to move those mics forward just a little bit, if you don't mind. I suppose it's quite obvious, is it, Myra, the role of a Tidy Towns organisation? Or maybe it might be useful, actually, to get your what you see it as. This is going to be a game of badminton, is it?
Just to clarify, Moira was our collaborator on the Seeds of Change programme.
Okay, so we'll talk more about that with you. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
And she did work with us last year, last summer, when we had a community art project going. So she was our first choice, naturally, when it came to picking someone to do the Seeds of Change programme.
Yeah. Talk to me about Rathmullen Tidy Towns then. You know, what is the scale of it and the work involved?
Well, we're only a small community, under 1,000 people in Rathmullen, but as you know, it's really doubles in size during the summer with daily commuters and being on the Wild Atlantic Way and tourists and everything else. So we try our best to have the village looking presentable and as nice and clean and tidy as possible. And quite honestly, litter is one of the biggest problems. Mm-hmm. Single-use plastics, takeaway coffee cups and things like that all the time. And then, of course, we're on the seacoast, so we have a lot of problems with early morning bird scavenging and things like that.
I'd love to, at one time or other, get a conversation with sort of a littering whistleblower, you know, someone who does it. Try and sort of get into the psyche of it. What's the attitude? What do they think of the area?
Yeah.
What do they think of the community? What do they think of the people that go out at the crack of dawn with a plastic bag and a litter picker? You know, I would love to speak to a litterer whistleblower just to understand why they care so little for the area and putting work on other people.
Yeah, it's amazing. But once you start litter picking, it nearly becomes... it's a great habit, but it's all consuming. And you only think we've got a litter problem here. My husband and I were away in a third world country there earlier in January, and you want to see the litter abroad.
Well, that's where we dump our rubbish.
But their rubbish is also coming to us.
No, but
single-use plastics.
No, I get you, but we send
sea.
It back. I mean, all the cheap clothing, a lot of the stuff that we recycle is dumped in North Africa.
But it's plastics as well, the single-use plastics, plastic bottles everywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, and part of our ethos through the Tidy Towns is single-use plastics and our fight against that. The reusable water bottle. Have your own coffee cup. Take it to your vendor.
I'll talk to more because I think you've been on a little bit of a journey in that regard more recently. I'm not saying you've always, you know.
Yeah.
So, Myra, talk to me about the work that you've done with Rathmullen Tidy Towns, if you don't mind.
So as part of the Tidy Towns in Rathmullen, they're very sustainable. They try and upcycle where they can. And they applied for seed funding from the Changemakers. And they asked me to facilitate a craft workshop. And I was absolutely delighted because I am an interior designer, but I'm passionate about crafting and I absolutely love crafting from anything that is literally household waste, everything upcycled, old book pages, scrap bits of fabric, old buttons. And it was just lovely for me to share that with the workshop participants. So instead of me sitting crafting at home on my own, I was able to go in and teach my skill to a group of people that I never would have met.
And I think there's an appetite for that because there are an awful lot of programs now, and programs don't get made consistently, that are about upcycling or, you know, saving stuff from being thrown out, repurposing it. A lot of people maybe started doing that during lockdown as well. So there is an appetite for it.
Well, definitely. It's getting more popular. And for me, it's just something I've always done. But through linking up with the Changemakers, you realise that there's lots of like-minded people out there and they strive for environmental justice and they want to have people to have upcycling and sustainability more as a part of their everyday lives. And that's where I go with my brand.
Can you give us some examples of some of the stuff you were teaching in the workshops or just demonstrating? I don't know how you want to describe
it. Yeah, so when... we did the workshop. It was to start in January, but because of weather, it was kind of the beginning of February before we started in the end, and it was seasonal. So we went for largely a spring and Easter theme. So the ladies made Easter decor for their houses, essentially, but we made it out of old books and old fabrics and buttons and a lot of book pages. We made paper flowers, made 3D bunnies. We made wreaths, out of scrap fabric. We just, literally things that were going to the bin.
Yeah.
And the ladies were amazed at how you could turn those into something beautiful.
Yeah, but you had to plant the creative seed, don't you? Because, I mean, I presume when it all came together, people were like, oh, yeah, of course, but you're there to sort of...
Well, you have to provide the inspiration,
yeah.
And that's what I wanted to do. Because I do it myself, but it's nice to share that with other people and make them realise that you don't have to buy new craft items, that you can actually repurpose stuff that... It's going to the bin.
Yeah. Okay. Hazel, you recently on your travels and you referenced it there, you know, the one-off plastics or the disposal of plastics and all that kind of stuff. Have you always been sort of careful in that regard or given what you've experienced recently on your travels, was that the wake-up call?
Not really, no. I've always been careful about that. I've always recycled. Even when I worked previously, we were always saving newspapers. We send them for... fundraising for a church. I recycle all my tins and cans. In fact, last week I was getting Moira to make us bees out of bean cans, and they were superb. They're now going to do it in the schools, and you know, we're encouraging the children. So when we work with the schools in Rathmullen as part of the Tidy Towns, we're teaching them how to grow plants and sustainability and pollinator friendly stuff in school. Then we have a school's garden as well. So the pupils bring their plants down and plant them in the
education
gardens.
Really
education
really is so important, isn't it?
Young.
Because to be honest with you, you know, maybe you can never give in, right? But maybe the people who are the litterers or those that don't care, maybe they're, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but there is generations coming through all the time. And listen,
absolutely.
It's their planet. So.
And they love getting out litter picking. And then they become so observant going forward, you know, about there's litter here. Or imagine someone throwing that there and they're picking it up and taking it away and putting it in the bin. You know,
do you think the likes of the deposit return scheme will have any impact?
I tried it the last day and I was having difficulty getting the bottle in now. So hopefully.
I just feel it's a bit of a, I think it's a, it's, it's a, it's, It's a bit of it. It's a tax on those that perhaps were already recycling
yes,
the stuff.
And I would agree.
I think those that are inclined to litter aren't going to be discouraged by 15 cents.
When we're picking up stuff on the sand dunes and, you know, in and around the town, and you see, you know, especially after last weekend when the weather was good, you're picking up six cans or six bottles that somebody's had their little picnic on the sand dunes and just walked away and left their stuff. Other stuff that's left very regularly is portable barbecues. So they're actually burying them in the sand, which is very dangerous for someone coming along and walking on the beach with small children, or smashing the bottles, you know, dropping them, smashing them. Sometimes I find it very hard to get my head around.
It's quite frustrating, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. But part of the upcycling and recycling we've always done in Rathmullen was the bicycles. We paint them, put flowers on them. We use wellies as well. You know, stuff that would otherwise be going to landfills.
So. And also, Myra, it's funny how attitudes has changed somewhat, and I hope it's not a fad, but if you went to a function or a wedding or something, you know, and someone says, you know, your dress is lovely, you'd be embarrassed to sort of say, right, I got it for €500 or €300 or something like that. But now what you hear is people go, yeah, I got this from a charity shop, it was just €5. So they're proud, they look great, right? But they're also not embarrassed to say that they've it's been repurposed or it was someone else's before and they got it for a really good price. I think it's good that that's become kind of cool. Now, as I don't know if it's just a little fad or a trend or if it's a change of mindset, but it's good that we are reusing stuff.
Yeah, but I think it's key as well to get into schools with that message.
Yeah.
You know, I have two daughters. I have three children, but I have two daughters. And the youngest one, she's 10 years old, and she's definitely more aware of her environment. She would be like, "Mommy, I don't need that jumper. I already have one."
Yeah.
My older daughter would be more inclined to consume, but it's trying to change that mindset of the teenagers, you know, that they know it's okay to shop in charity shops, which it is. I'm a big advocate of charity shops. I buy stuff for all my family there, and I'm delighted with the bargains that I get. And also you feel like you can justify buying that extra dress because it's already there. You're just reusing it.
But when you can go in and get a brand new white T-shirt for €4 and a polo shirt for €7, 15 socks for £6, and a shirt for £12, you know, it's going to be hard to change mindsets, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think
it feels disposable.
Yeah, but it's something that we have to strive to do. Mm. I mean, that's something that we need to educate our children about, and you have to start when they're young, because otherwise they'll not do it.
Yeah.
But it's definitely something that I aim towards.
Okay, brilliant stuff. Hazel, just an appeal, I suppose, as we head into the busy time of the year. Unfortunately, we've had a lot of hedge cutting and grass cutting, and it's exposed a lot of the crap and rubbish that's been dumped over the winter period. It'd be lovely if the change makers could be those that dump to stop doing so.
It would, yeah, but it's going to be an education system, really, isn't it? You know, everybody has to learn. And you're saying about the hedge cutting and the grass cutting. The weather, winter was very bad, so a lot of people sort of extended on in then to April. So we're coming into no mow May then, which is at the moment, you know, but the litter is a huge problem just.
All right, listen, both of you, thank you very much indeed. It's been lovely speaking to you, Myra McHugh and Hazel Russell. Thanks very much indeed. Okay, it is the 9 till noon show here in Highland Radio. More guests on the way. Right, we're joined in our studio area here by Michael McLaughlin, who's creative director of Disappear Here Film Festival and Club. Good morning to you. Thanks so much for dropping by, Michael. How are you keeping?
Good morning, Greg. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
Talk to us about Disappear Here Film Festival and Club.
Okay, so the festival has been running since 2017, and so we're going into our seventh year this year, and I suppose we're really starting to find our feet now after 7 years of running through lockdown, running first of all for a number of years successfully and then having to go online during lockdown. But we have rebounded, and last year we could see numbers back up, and I think that was kind of reflective of events, arts events anyway, where numbers were down across the board, but we've started seeing people go back to seated spaces, and that was great to see from last year. So in the last couple of years, we've been working with Myra at Donegal Changemakers and with the IDP through the Film Club, which is a monthly event that we run in Clonmany normally, but we have done satellite events in Dunbuncrana for Inishowen Pride and in Carndona for a recent Palestinian screening that we did in the Colgan Hall. So it's a monthly film club that aims to sort of shed light and amplify the message, I suppose, of social, environmental, sort of global issues that have local resonance and impact as well, and really try to, I guess, start the conversation on some of those bigger issues at a local level.
And how do you broaden the audience so that you don't end up with a cohort that you're effectively preaching to the converted?
So I suppose you have to use, cleverly have to use social media, number one. We use our newsletter, number two. And we try to get, I suppose, a diverse selection of films that we're using, so it isn't the same people interested in the same things, and it doesn't become, as you say, like an echo chamber. We try to have a very diverse selection of creative work that we're showing, and then we also bring along people that are experts in those fields to talk in sort of post-show discussions, where maybe people that maybe ordinarily wouldn't come to a film club are looking at the type of speakers that we have, and mm-hmm. then they make that decision to come along. Mm. So it's really important that it's not an echo chamber, and it's really important that people can take sort of active steps after a screening to go and impact that change in their communities.
Yeah, and it's sort of baby steps, isn't it? It's like... It's the opposite of death by a thousand cuts. I don't know what the opposite of that might be, but do you know what I mean? It's like, and I was just speaking to guests earlier on, if you were to sort of start, you'd be saying, well, how does this make a change? How does this impact? How does this, you know, change people's attitudes? But I suppose it's a whole series of things and sticking with it.
Yeah, well, I guess it starts with the screening. You know, it starts with the message that's contained within the screening, particularly if it's the film club or the film festival, and then, you know, extrapolating that out across the post-screening discussion, and then giving people sort of, you know, real solid things that they can take away to implement in their own lives. For instance, the Palestinian screening that we had in the Colgan Hall last week, like, people are really feeling helpless about the war, yeah, in Palestine at the minute, and, like, you know, there's a loss of hope. So people were, the constant question we were being asked was, like, what can we do at a local level? How can we impact change here? So, you know, and we were able to give them a leaflet to take away to talk about, like, how local activism works in terms of the Palestinian war. And, people were very, I suppose, grateful to have, you know, something that they could actually start to work on.
Yeah, and you talk about showing films that, you know, resonate locally. I mean, we know there's always been a really strong affinity between most of the Irish people, I think, and the people of Palestine.
Yeah, for sure. And we're seeing that, you know, come to the fore more as we're seeing more and more people who maybe never considered activism but are, you know, feeling so dismayed and horrified by what they're seeing on the ground in Gaza and across the West Bank, that really they want to step up and just, you know, to provide those small acts of solidarity that are being seen, you know, in Gaza. They are being seen in the West Bank, and, you know, so that the Palestinians don't feel alone.
Yeah. From your own perspective and your own filmmaking, have you the time to be working on any projects at the moment?
I have a couple of things in the mix at the moment, but I have spent some time in Palestine myself. I made a number of films while I was there in the West Bank. One I actually made in Bethlehem in a refugee camp, and I actually have a second part of that film that I'm trying to pull together at the moment. It's in post, and it's just a constant evolving thing there that, I suppose, as a creative, sometimes you're always kind of looking for this perfection, and you're aiming for something that is solid enough to go out into the world, and because Palestine is such an evolving,
Palestinian has to fit into the now, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And eventually I'm going to just have to call a line and say this is it, and put it out there. But I'm constantly tweaking and adding to that project, so I hope to have that ready.
All right, listen, Michael, it's been lovely speaking to you. Thank you so very much indeed. That's Michael McLaughlin, creative director of Disappear Here Film Festival and Club. And sitting to his right is Emma Rose Callaghan, operations manager at on Green and Hotel here. Good morning to you, Emma Rose. Thank you so much for joining us. It's good to have you on board. How are things going for you here?
Yeah, not too bad. We are kind of coming back into our busy season now again. We've come through our January and February, getting the kickstart with the wedding season. We've been busy with First Communions, confirmations coming up as well. So we're kinda...
So when is the wedding season, sorry?
Our wedding season is anywhere from March time right through until the end of the year, through until December, yeah.
And I'm not sure it ever was the case. It's not just a Saturday thing now anymore, is it?
Oh, no,
not here, I mean just in the wedding scene more generally. So How many weddings might you do a week on a busy week?
On a busy week, in our peak in August, we're looking at maybe five or six. Oh, yeah. Wow. That's our peak
That's
season.
That's a huge turnaround daily, isn't it?
Because
play such a vital role in what is for many people the most important or one of the most important days of their life. Everything has to be perfect.
Of course. And we've got a fantastic team behind us, a team here with a wealth of experience. We've got some very long-standing members of staff who could do it with their eyes closed. They know exactly what they're doing. We've got a great setup team, the staff in the kitchen, our chefs, housekeeping, everybody. Everybody comes together to make it work on a special day, especially on a wedding day.
And when, for you, does the tourism season start, in your mind, if you know what I mean, not necessarily from a business perspective?
We always have like a point of saying St. Patrick's Day onwards. That's kind of where you've got St. Patrick's Day, Mother's Day, Easter usually falls around. I know we had like a month there of madness where there was three big weekends for everybody. So they were good weekends. It was good to get those. So we find that, from March, we kind of start to kick in, and our peak season then is obviously kind of around the August.
August and your sort of, I know there's so many different types, but what is your tourist, if you know what I mean? Are they sort of basing themselves here and traveling around the place? Are they on the Wild Atlantic Way? Can you sort of give us an example of the type of tourist that stays here and bases themselves here?
Yeah, we're usually a stop-off point on the Wild Atlantic Way. So there's some people would be coming and staying for a one-night or a two-night stay. We do work with the European tour companies as well and Irish tour companies. So recently we've had German travellers, we've had French, Spanish. Towards the end of last season, we actually had some Japanese tourists staying with us as well. So you would find that usually they would stay for maybe a one or a two night stay. Mm. And we're slotted in because we're so close to Angrenan Fort and because we are on the peninsula of Inishowen and so close to Derry City as well, that when they're on their travels, we are that little stop off for their rest.
Yeah. And finally, businesses like this are very important in the community as well, aren't they? Because they're a venue for community events, fundraising events as well. So that all has to be accommodated over the course of the year too.
Exactly, and there has been some amazing fundraising initiatives held here in the past couple of months, even in the past few weeks. So we're always there to help support the local community and work with anybody that is out there and looking to hold an event. We're always there. We've got the big function room. There's no point in having it empty. We're always trying to get a little bit of life into it. So.
Brilliant. Okay, well, continued success, Emma Rose. It's lovely to see you again, and the place is always looking fantastic. Thank you very much for having us today. I really do appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. That's Emma Rose Callahan, operations manager here at Angrenan Hotel. Right, we have still quite a bit to get into the last few moments of the 9 till noon show, but we first have to take this quick break. Okay, so mist and fog has cleared now, and to leave a mix of cloud and sunny spells, it'll be largely dry day, but there is a chance of a few heavy showers developing in the afternoon and evening. I'm joined by two guests now as we head towards the end of the programme. I want to say good morning first to Leanne McLaughlin. Good morning, Leanne.
Good morning. How are you doing?
How are you keeping?
I'm very good. Thank you.
Good stuff. Thank you so much for joining us. And also Alita Umbofu. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you are two participants in the Change Makers Donegal Intercultural Studies course. Leanne, can you tell me a little bit about it and your experience?
We participated on the course for 6 weeks. It was a six-week programme supported by the Changemakers and connected with A2B. We spent a lot of time within the group exchanging stories, creating exchanges between ourselves and understanding about our differences and our similarities. During the time, we made great friends. And we felt really, really quite inspired going out into the community, that I was living in for to become more integrated in deeply in the community where I am based at the minute.
And did going through this process sort of bring out what was already in you, or was there a true growth and learning on your behalf, Leanne?
There was a lot of learning on my behalf, professionally an artist, and as from a professional point of view, I looked at my practice in delivering workshops that were directly connected with integration and acceptance and inclusion. And this has impacted me extremely. The ripple effect has come through in every piece of work that I've done since doing the intercultural program.
Olita, tell me of your experience, please.
It's been a learning journey. It has raised a lot of awareness. It has also gotten me into questioning my own cultural beliefs, my own biases, and it has made me actually more aware in each and every environment that I am in. I need to always be aware of my surroundings. So it was quite a learning journey for me.
And can you explain that a little bit more without, I'm not trying to ask you to say everything publicly,
yeah,
but can you give us an example of what you mean when you say to sort of consider your surroundings a little bit more?
So when you are... Ireland is a very diverse country. You are in a room with a lot of different people. So you need to be in a sense of understanding cultural diversity. And also I learned the importance of being an effective communicator, effective communication across cultures. And it actually gave me a great sense of empathy. And also I learned how to always challenge my decisions before making them.
Leanne, is it possible for you to identify, you know, one of the greater things that you've learned?
I think that looking back, as Aletha said, it's a more sense of awareness. As a reiteration, really, what you said, it's a sense of awareness that no matter where you are, you have to have a level of acceptance of the people around you and an understanding to kind of foster a community always wherever you are of empathy and acceptance. That has definitely had an impact, and I notice that I do it wherever I am. I don't do it now consciously. It is almost subconscious.
And presumably it's a transferable skill.
Yes.
If you know what I mean,
it's
something you can bring into your home life, your friends group or whatever.
With your family, okay. Especially with children.
Yes.
It's really important.
Olita, you would encourage anyone able to access access one of these intercultural study courses to do so?
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely. It is a life-changing experience in such a way that you don't only leave the knowledge that you acquired in class, you get to apply it in your everyday life. So I would advise anyone to go through with it.
Okay. Olita, Leanne, both of you, thank you very much indeed. I really do appreciate it. And unfortunately, that's where we have to leave it on the programme today. I want to thank Oisin Kelly, who helped with the technical side of things, Shannon, and of course, the ever-present Caroline Orr. Thank you very much for listening and bearing with us. We are back on Monday morning, and it begins our series of debates as we head... Oisin Kelly's already packing up. Our series of debates as we head towards the local and European elections. We kick off with from 10 o'clock or just after 10, a panel of local council election candidates, and also then that will be followed by an online exclusive debate with European candidates. All have been invited. The majority have accepted those invites. We'll tell you more about that, of course, on Monday morning. But for me, Greg Hughes, and the team, enjoy your weekend and stay tuned.